The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What we're going to do, especially bearing in mind that there's a very wide variety of people in this room, which is kind of like what we like here, including a very diverse set of backgrounds and a diverse set of, I don't like the word levels because we're all, you know, sort of where we're meant to be, but, you know, different directions and different levels of experience. And so we're going to see if we can sort of create an experience that binds everybody together. And what we thought we would do, or what I thought I would do for this series of classes, is actually to take what we call patterns in time. You know, one of the central themes of Judaism, Judaism has certain central themes, and they run through different aspects of Judaism. And one of them are the festivals, the Chagim. And very often, we don't appreciate, because we get so into a festival, when we're into the festival, people around Pesach, they talk around Pesach, and people around, you know, Hanukkah, talk about Hanukkah, etc. We want to see if we can create a pattern that gives us a chance to explore a little piece of each of these festivals. And I hope that two things will come of this. First of all, I hope the festivals become much more than just the ritual experience that many people have. I think there are some very deep messages that are life lessons that are part of not just individual chagim, individual festivals, but just the pattern of how they fit together. And I hope as well that we'll get a chance to discover things that we didn't know before. And I just want to encourage you, because there's such a wide variety of backgrounds, if I say something and you don't follow what I say, whether it's a word like chag, which means festival, and I forget to translate it, please don't hesitate to interrupt me. I really don't mind. You know, there's a saying in the Mishnah and Ethics of the Fathers, Eina Bashan Lamed, the person who is embarrassed doesn't learn anything, so don't be embarrassed, right? And after a class, if you didn't feel you chopped something, if you didn't get something, then don't hesitate to come over and ask as many times as it takes for you to get it. If you don't want to get it, then that's a different story. This last summer was a very difficult summer on many different levels. And without getting into the politics of it, you know, giving up a portion of the land of Israel after 2,000 years and after what we've gone through as a people to be able to experience the land of Israel, whether you're on the right or on the left or anywhere in the middle, that should bother you. That should be a painful experience. There are those who believe it will lead to peace. There are those who believe it will lead to war. Everywhere in the middle, I don't want to get into the politics. But very challenging. And especially challenging that Jews were asking, telling, whatever word you choose to use, depending on your political perspective, Jews to leave their homes. That's a very painful experience. So many of us spent the summer going to rallies. And that's a whole discussion which I'm happy to have, you know, one late night, the value or the disvalue of that. But I'll just describe to you one moment from one of those rallies. I was personally very bothered by the fact that all these rallies were taking place down in Sderot and, you know, opposite Gush Katif, etc., even though that may be where the experience was taking place, because the people who were down at those rallies were the people who already got it, you know. So finally they decided to be smart, and they had a rally up in Tel Aviv. And the pundits, you know, they debate the numbers, but there were probably about 250,000 people who came to this rally. It was packed. All of Kikar Rabin, Malchei Yisrael, was packed. And what was unique about this rally was this was the first time, at least, that I saw that the group wasn't so, you know, homogeneous, unidimensional. There were people with kippot, people without kippot. You know, I don't like the labels. I think they do us a tremendous disservice. But just so you understand the experience, there are people with long black coats and people with jeans and everywhere in the middle. And it was very interesting to see. And I don't know if everybody came because they identified or people came because they wanted other people to feel that they feel their pain. But there was a certain sense of crossing boundaries, you know. You can't be with 250,000 Jews in a place where all 250,000 Jews are attempting to achieve something and not feel something. You just can't. It's an enormous thing. And at one point in the evening, there's a fellow by the name of Ophir Cohen, who's somebody I know from years ago, who lives in Gush Katif. He's unfortunately made news. He used to run a midrasha in the Beit Kalim, a study center, and about, gosh, I don't even remember, 4 years ago, 5, 10 years ago, there was a terrible bombing near Tzomet Kisufim, near the Kisufim Junction, and a school bus full of children was hit by an anti-personnel mine that they planted in the road, and a number of children were killed. And he and his wife had three children on this bus. And all three of these children survived, but all three of these children needed to have amputations as a result of this experience. And they basically had the operations on the same day, and they were in two different hospitals, right? So the entire country kind of grabbed onto this story. And the most incredible part of this experience was just the enormous faith that this couple displayed. The children didn't want to leave Gush Katif. You would think that they would want to get away from trauma. They believed in where they were. This was their home. The parents were interviewed on the news about a week later and were speaking about how much, you know, I remember at one point the interviewer was asking his wife, so doesn't this make you angry? And she was saying, you know, anger is such a waste of energy and it's not about them. That would be about me. And just a beautiful interview. No venom, no hatred, no anger. Just, you know, we have to find ways to create peace. It's magnificent. Right? You couldn't be on any piece of the spectrum and not be in awe at this couple's interview. You know, just exuding love. You know, what light is supposed to be about. So here we are 10 years later, 8 years later, whatever it is, and they're about to kick this family out of their home. Agree with it, disagree with it, that's not my point. So she gets up on the stage and she's talking. And at one point she starts to cry. Okay? I tell you, 250,000 people are standing in the square of Kikar Rabin. You could have heard a pin drop. She starts crying. And she says, the only thing I don't understand, what am I going to tell my son, who's still in a wheelchair, when an Israeli soldier comes to his home and tells him that he has to take him out of his home? And again, I'm not debating the politics of this. Right? Just a painful experience. And at that moment, you know, I mean, just this collective, I can't even describe it. It was just this energy drop, you know. People are just contemplating this. And then they put this music on, and they started to play this song. And I had heard this song, but I never really heard this song, you know. And everyone I was looking at around where I was standing started singing this song. And I've never had the experience of being amongst 250,000 people who were all singing the same song. That's just an unbelievable experience. And it raises an interesting question. Now, I want to teach you this niggun, even though it'll take a minute from our class, just because, for two reasons. First, because I'm hoping over the course of the week we'll get to share a few niggunim. And a niggun, by the way, is a tune without words. This one actually has words, but I don't know if we'll get to the words, because we kind of sometimes have to learn to get beyond the words, right? I hope that we'll get to learn a few niggunim together, just, you know, because that's also part of what Israelite is. But also because what we're going to study in a minute, you won't get unless I share this niggun with you. You have to trust me. So for some of you, this may be a little weird, but this is such an amazing niggun. And to learn a song in the old city of Yerushalayim, it doesn't get better than that. So it goes like this. Forget the words. Later sometime I'll tell you the words, right? Rachem, it's actually from the grace after meals. Okay, and the first word is Rachem, that Hashem, that God should have mercy, right? And, you know, when you go through difficult experiences, even if you think it's the right thing to do, and I could hear both sides of the coin, even though I obviously have my opinions, but it should still cause you pain that there are experiences that are causing others pain. So it goes like this. Forget the words. We'll just do the words now. Are going to be very simple. 9999999. Okay, get it? Hey, na na. Try that. Hey, na na. Na 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 na. Hey, na na. Hey, try that. Na 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 na. Then it goes like this. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Na 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 na
na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na.
Just want to do it one more time so everybody gets it.
Hey, yeah, na. Hey, yeah, na, 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 na. Hey, na, na. Na, 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 na. Hey, na, 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 na. Ay na na, ay na na.
Second part goes like this.
Ay na 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 na. Now you try that. Ay na 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 na. Ay na 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 na.
Imagine what that must be like with 250,000 people singing that in Tel Aviv. But that's why that song has stayed on my mind for about a year. And the reason I'm sharing this nigun with you is because it raises an interesting question. Every once in a while, you get to experience a moment like that. You get to experience a moment where the walls come down, the differences disappear because they just don't matter, and you experience what oneness is meant to be. And you may know in your heart that it doesn't last, and maybe it doesn't last because you know it doesn't last. If you didn't know it didn't last, maybe it would last. But it's a mixture of pleasure and pain. It's a mixture of pleasure because it's such a pure experience to be with so many people, right? And you don't have to think about 250,000 people in Kikar Malchei Yisrael. When you sing a niggun, and you're in a room, and most people here haven't met each other before, right? And all the boundaries just go away. And then you kind of come back to reality. Right? What is it that we're missing? How is it that we get there? And I want you to understand where this question comes from, because you can't study what we're about to study in a vacuum. Right? It has to relate to who we are and where we are and what we're experiencing. You know, This last summer, when the Jewish people go through a trauma, there's a message there. There's something we need to learn, right? And if we're losing a piece of Israel, maybe it's because somehow we're not worthy of having Israel, right? All the excuses that we use, you know, left, right, Arabs, Jews, government, police, whatever excuses are on your lips, they're just symptoms. The issue is bigger than that. And it's interesting that the word that is used, right, in English they called it the disengagement, in Hebrew we called it the hitnatkut, right? Whenever the Jewish people grab onto a word, that has symbolism, that has significance, right? So what does it mean to be minutak? Hitnatkut, the disengagement, right? So to be minutak, right? It's like if I walk into a room and you're on the phone, and I have something important to tell you, I say, no, titnatek, like cut off the line. To be minutak is to be cut off. And I've been wondering since last summer, if maybe there's some message that we're too cut off. We're cut off from each other. We live in our islands. We come here with labels. Are you religious? Are you irreligious? Are you reform? Are you conservative? Are you orthodox? Are you ultra-orthodox? Are you conservadox? Are you left-wing orthodox, but reconstructionist on the weekends? Or whatever place in between you happen to be, we've created our boxes. And I guess what fascinates me, and what I hope that we're going to get to over the course of this week, is how we got there, and whether Judaism has a recipe for getting out of there. Now, here's an interesting question for you. We're going to take a look at some of the chagim. If you had to pick a ritual, a chag, a festival, to begin with, on two levels. First of all, what's the beginning? What's the first holiday? Okay. And second of all, maybe which holiday would you think is most related to this topic? So first of all, what's the first holiday?
Pesach.
Pardon? Pesach, right? Now, it's interesting that we commemorate Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is really the beginning. It's called Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year. It commemorates the beginning of civilization, the beginning of mankind, and it should be the beginning. And the Torah begins by telling us that Rosh Hashanah is the beginning, but then somewhere along the way, it stops being the beginning. And we're going to have to figure out why. Right? The first mitzvah that the Jewish people are given is a Chodesh Hazeh Lachem or Sheikh Chodeshim. This is for you a new month, the beginning of months, the head of months. So Nisan, the month of Pesach, of Passover, that's the beginning. But that's not really the beginning. It's like everything else that's Jewish. It's complicated, right? It's a beginning that isn't quite a beginning. So if you had to choose a word, the beginning Rosh Hashanah and the beginning of Pesach, what would you say is the difference? Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of? Well, the year, but Nisan is the beginning of the year. If you chop my kids, right? My youngest is 7. And you say to him, quick, give me the months of the year. Right? In fact, my kids were just talking about this. I never realized this. You take things for granted. My daughter, who's now just turned 10, doesn't know the order of the English months. Like, she doesn't know January, February, March. I never really thought about that. It's not like you sit down and have the syllabus that you have to get your kids. Because they didn't really teach that in her school. It's not important to them, January, February. She'll get it, you know. If you ask them what their order of the months, they'll say Nisan, Yasi, Yivan, Tammuz. That's what they'll do. They start with Nisan. Right? So, it is a beginning, and it isn't a beginning. So what's the difference between Tishrei and Nisan, Rosh Hashanah and Pesach? So I would say maybe that Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the individual, the creation of humanity, man, whatever that means. And Nisan is the beginning of the nation. So Pesach is the beginning of the nation. So I'm going to choose to start with Pesach. Okay? We could start with Rosh Hashanah, but we'll start with Pesach. Now, by the way, there's a halacha in the Gemara. The Gemara, the Talmud teaches us, Shloshim yom lifnei achag dorshin et achag, 30 days before a festival, you begin to study the festival. There's a period of time before something that's really the beginning of something. And we could have a long discussion. That in and of itself is a topic, right? So what's 30 days before Pesach? Purim. Purim, and if you don't know what these words are, don't worry, we'll get there, right? Purim is a festival that's 30 days before Pesach. So really we should start with Purim. However, Purim's in Adar, which is the last month. So that's really the ending. But it's really the beginning. So it gets confusing. So when I think of the year, I don't think of a line. I think of a circle. Now, if it's really a circle, it doesn't really matter where you are, right? Do you know what the beginning is right now? Right now, the beginning is the seventh day of Tammuz, because that's today. Today is the beginning of our year. And tomorrow will be the beginning of the year, and the next day will be the beginning of the year, and we could wax on mystical, and we could drive each other's nuts. But we're going to start with Pesach, okay? But I want you to understand that that's just a random point. Okay, so now here's an interesting question. I want to share with you a Gemara, a Talmudic. I don't know what you would call it, a story, a discussion. It's an interesting question what you would call it. I want to share with you a piece of Gemara, because I also want to try to do a little text in and out of these classes. And there's something about this Gemara that blew my mind. Just blew my mind. If, by the way, just as an addendum, even though this wasn't the mission in doing these classes, you're going to, God willing, walk away from here with a class and an amazing, I hope, a wonderful discussion for pretty much every festival of the year. So if you keep yourself this material and you file it wherever you file it, or you get the tape at the end of the thing, when you come to Pesach next year, you'll have a whole discussion group. You can get a discussion group together and you can study in your home and you'll have a class prepared. And you'll have one on Rosh Hashanah and you'll have one on Yom Kippur and you'll have one on Sukkot and whatever it might be. Okay. So I want to share this with you, Gemara. This is from the Tractate of Chulin. I'm going to spare, if anybody's curious to know, you know, there's a very mixed audience in the room. Some of you have more familiarity with the Talmud, some of you have less familiarity with the Talmud. If you would like, over one of the meals this week, to get a little more knowledge, how the Talmud worked, why the Talmud was created, what's so important about the Talmud, Mishnah, Gemara, Tosefta, Braitot, whatever it is, I am happy to sit with you over the course of any meal you want, or after a class, whatever. So file these questions away if they come up. Okay. So listen to this, Gemara. Okay, this is in the Tractate of Chulin. Chulin, by the way, is a tractate in the Talmud that deals largely with the laws of kosher, of kashrut. It's a very detail-oriented tractate. It deals with the laws of the knives of a butcher, and whether the udders, you know, how you, whether the milk inside an udder is kosher, what makes an animal kosher or unkosher, how you slaughter an animal, all sorts of very complex laws that have to do with kashrut, which makes this story all the more strange. What is this story doing here at the end of the tractate? It's almost the end of the tractate. And you would think that the Gemara would finish off with sort of some of the essential ideas of the tractate, and all of a sudden they come up with these stories. Okay? One more detail about stories in the Talmud. We call the stories in the Talmud Agadah. Okay? And again, I don't have time to get into how that works, but there are basically two parts of Torah. There is the written tradition and the oral tradition. Written tradition is this book, you know, which I guess we'll get to also, right? Written tradition. And the oral tradition is these books, the Talmud, right? And how they got written down is a whole other discussion. In the oral tradition, there are two parts of the oral tradition. There's what's called Halakha, and that's what's called Agadah. Halakha is the what, where, when, and how. You know, if you heard that on Shabbat, you know, we don't cook on Shabbat, what does that mean? You know, if I'm playing frisbee with an omelet and I pass it to you and it gets warmed in the sun, is that cooking? Right? What different? So there's a whole discussion. How do you define cooking? How hot does it have to be? What if you're making a cup of tea with tea bags according to the uraim or whatever it might be, right? And then there's, you know, and that's important, you know, that's the tradition, that's how the details work. But then there's the why. Now, halacha doesn't cover the why. Okay? The why is the purview of the Agadah. Okay? This is, why are we doing this? What does this mean? What are we supposed to learn from it? And all the essential philosophical, theological, existential issues of Jewish tradition are hidden in these stories. Okay? And there's a whole debate as to whether you have to assume that these stories happened. Okay? There are enough significant commentaries. The Vilna Gaon, the Rashbam, who was one of the grandchildren of Rashi, the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Luchaim Lutzata, one of the great Torah authorities of the last few hundred years, who actually believed that Agadah was not meant to be taken literally. And therefore, it doesn't matter to me whether you accept that a story in the Agadah happened or didn't happen. You know, famous, I don't know, legend about Abraham in his father's store breaking idols. According to these commentaries, you don't have to believe that Avram's father had an idol store. You could, and it could well have happened, but that's not the point of the Agadah. Agadah is not a history book. Right? Could have happened, could have didn't. I personally think that many of them did happen, and many of them didn't happen. It's totally not my issue. It's like you're in the middle of a discussion with somebody who wants to make a point. He says, I'll give you an example. And you interrupt his example and say, well, did it really happen? It doesn't matter if it happens, I'm giving you an example. So the real question is what we learned from this. Bear that in mind while we read the story. Okay, this is a strange story. So I'm going to read in the Aramaic and the Hebrew on the left. And you can follow along in English if you want, but at least this way you'll have it for review. Okay, so we're on the left-hand column on the top. So there's a halacha you should just know about called kal, kaf chet lamed kal. Kal is an udder. Now this is an interesting complexity, because you know, you have a cow, okay? You slaughter a cow, and the cow is meat. And you know that we have a tradition that we don't eat meat with milk, right? What if I slaughter a cow, the cow's dead, right? So now I take the udder, it's part of a kosher animal, I could eat the udder. Whether you would want to eat the udder is an interesting question, but you can eat the udder if you want. What about the milk that's inside the udder? Is the milk inside the udder milk or meat? So in fact, technically speaking, pardon? Oi. Like, oi! Oi! That is exactly it. That is the answer. You're ready for rabbinical school. That's right. Oi. Right?
So is the milk inside the udder milk or meat? Interesting question.
So in fact, technically speaking, by the way, just another disclaimer, nobody should walk away from any of the discussions that we're going to have this week with even the vaguest concept that you have learned halacha in this class, that you have received some sort of halachic rule. These are very complex laws, and we're not studying halacha here. So when you hear something sort of by the by, don't assume you know the rule, because I'm using examples and whatever. If you're curious, you can come over afterwards. All right. So let's just say that technically speaking, generally speaking, that once an animal is slaughtered, whatever was part of the animal, when it was slaughtered, it's considered meat, right? Or at least it's not considered milk. And therefore, technically speaking, the milk that's inside the udder is not milk. There is one other example of milk that isn't milk. Anybody know what it is? Milk that isn't milk? Coconut milk. Coconut milk is not milk. It doesn't come from a cow, right? The whole issue of a cow is that I don't boil the cow in its mother's milk. Coconut is not mother's milk. So if you want to have fun, you know, you take some milk from a coconut, you take a piece of meat, you flatten them together, you have a milk and meat sandwich, and you feel great. Okay. Whether you can do this or people think you're eating milk and meat, well, that depends on how many rocks you want to get, but that's up to you. But anyway, so technically speaking, the milk and the udder itself, right? Now, there's a big debate about the milk, and many authorities say that you take the milk out because it looks like, well, that's a whole discussion. But the udder, technically speaking, is not considered milk, even though there's milk taste to it, right? It's not milk. Okay. So now, here's an interesting thing. Basura, there were two major yeshivot in Babylon, in Bava. There was Sura and Pampadita. There was a third, Nardah, but whatever, okay? In Sura, Basura, lo achli kachle. In Sura, they were very stringent. They didn't eat kha. They didn't eat these udders, okay? But Pampadita, but in the other yeshiva, in Pampadita, achli kachle, they ate udders, right? Because if one community doesn't do it, you gotta do it, right? Because otherwise we're not Jews, right? Okay. So Basura, lo achli kachle, but Pampadita, achli kachle. Rami bar Tamre, to who Rami bar Dikle? There's a fellow named Rami bar Dikle. He's Rami, the son of Gates. There is significance to names, but we're not going to get there. Right? He was from Pumbedita. So he's from the udder-eating group. He lives in udder-eater land. Okay? But he's now Ikla Lasura. He is visiting, or ends up, in Sura. So he's now in a community that doesn't eat udders. Right? Bemale Yoma de Kippure. And this is the eve of Yom Kippur. Okay? He happens to end up in Sura on the eve of Yom Kippur. Right? Okay. Afkinu kule alma lekachlinu. So the whole world, the whole neighborhood, they're all throwing out their udders, right? They're all slaughtering cows, because we know that on Yom Kippur we're going to fast tomorrow. So on the eve of Yom Kippur, we're all shechting our cows, we're slaughtering our cows, we're making a big feast. It's one of my favorite halachot of the whole year. It's a mitzvah to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. You get as much reward for eating on the eve of Yom Kippur as you do for fasting on Yom Kippur. I'm very stringent about that halacha, very important, okay? Right? So everybody's getting ready to eat, so what are they doing? They're all throwing out their udders, because they don't eat udders. Right? So this guy, right? Azal iyu, naktinu, lachlinu. So this guy's in utter heaven. Because he's walking down the street, and everybody's throwing out, like, you know, Big Macs, right? So he's in heaven. So he's grabbing udders, and he's eating udders. He's happy, okay? Aitu ala kamedu Rav Chisda. So they see this guy. Shkatz. He's eating udders. You know? Vastotlach, what's the matter with you? Right? So they bring him before Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda was the head of the yeshiva. Okay, the yeshiva was the center of this community, and the head of the yeshiva was basically like the rabbi of town. So they haul him before Rav Chisda. Okay, he's in front of the big rabbi because he was caught udder eating. Okay, so they bring him in front of Rav Chisda. Amalei amayte avid hachi. So he says to him, what'd you do this for? What are you eating udders? Amalei me'atra de Rav Yehuda. Now, I'm from the town, in other words, the yeshiva of Rav Yehuda, the head of Pumbedita. We eat udders, right? Me'atra de Rav Yehuda. Now, I'm from the town of Rav Yehuda, the achil, and we eat these udders. Amalei, he says to him, don't you know that you're supposed to keep the stringencies of the place you come from and the stringencies of the place you go to? In other words, if you come to my community and we're stringent about something, you got to get stringent about it because you're in my community, right? Amalei, he says to him, I walked out of the municipal boundary. And I walk 2,000 cubits, I'm out of the municipal boundary of the town, so I can eat it, right? And you can almost picture this guy. You'll see as the Gemara goes on, this guy was like a wise aleck. He goes to the edge of town, down an udder, can't eat it, but now I can, right? Okay? So Rav Chisda, apparently, is getting a little annoyed by this. Shtikel chutzpah, right? He says, okay, I went out of tchum, right? I went out of the town limits. Ubamet vatinu, you know, so what did you cook it with? How'd you cook it? Amalei beportzini. The little twigs by the side of the vineyards, Rashi says, okay? The little twigs, I found little twigs, I made myself a little fire. right? V'dilma miyayin nesech havia. If you use twigs from the vineyards, maybe they belong to an idolater, and maybe they were used in idolatrous practice, and therefore, you can't use those twigs. Amalei la'acha shnemesach chodesh. So this guy, he's a sharp guy, because he learns Pupadita, he's a sharp guy. He says, nope, these were 12-month-old twigs. And twigs, even if they're from idolatrous practice, once they dry up after 12 months, right? No more idolatry, I can eat them. No problem, I'm covered, right? So now Rav Chisda is getting annoyed. This guy has an answer for everything, right? V'dilma degezel havei, maybe it's stolen. Maybe somebody owned the field and he was one day going to go collect his twigs. How do you know? You didn't ask twig permission, right? Amalei yeush balim havei dekatchu behu, right? Because I saw, right, dekatchu behu chilfei. I saw they were like moss. There was like weeds growing out of the twigs. So once there's moss, weeds, disgustingness growing out of the twigs, then whoever had them would for sure have given up on them, so I know they're not theft. In other words, I'm super genius. I know all the halachic rules, I checked my twigs, and I found mossy twigs, no problem, right? So whoever would have owned them would have given up on them, and therefore I'm allowed to eat them, right? Chazia, so he sees, delo havim monach tefillin. So now they're already talking. So Rav Chisda sees this guy is not wearing tefillin. Now, it used to be that we used to wear tefillin all day. And at a certain point, we stopped wearing tefillin all day because we're not on the level to keep the concentration, purity of thought that would be required to wear tefillin all day. But in these days, and certainly in Surah, they wore tefillin all day. So he says to Nu, right, Amalei, my time in the Lo Mincha tefillin, why are you not wearing tefillin? Which is a nice way of saying, Nu, shekets. What's the matter with you? You're not even wearing tefillin, right? Amalei, cholim yayin havei. No, I have like an intestinal disease. I think that's a nice way of saying I have the runs. Okay, I have the runs. So I have to keep going to the bathroom. For Amar of Yehuda, and our Rosh Hashiva and Pumpadita, he ruled, Cholim Ayin Pater Min HaTefillin, that if somebody has the runs, he doesn't have to keep his phone on because it'll be disrespectful to him. Run to the bathroom, back from the bathroom, run to the bathroom, right? Chazi Delo Havi Karami Chute. So he sees he's not wearing strings. In other words, tzitzis, right? Tzitzis are the strings that we wear. It's a traditional biblical commandment. So he sees he's not wearing tzitzis, right? So, Amalei, my time a late lachute. How come you're not wearing tzitzis? Shegitz, what's the matter with you? Right? Amalei, talit shulahi. Nope, this is a borrowed shirt. For Amar of Yehuda, now we continue in the next column. Amar of Yehuda, talit shulah, kol shloshim yom, ptura mina tzitzis. If you borrow someone's shirt, technically, if you have a four-cornered garment, so the Bible says, the Torah says, you put tzitzit on it and it reminds you of who you are, where you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to do. But if you borrow somebody else's shirt and it doesn't have tzitzit, you're not obligated, according to Rav Yehuda, according to the Pumpadita guy community, right? You're not obligated to put tzitzit on the shirt. You understand what's going on here? It's Erev Yom Kippur. They're sitting in front of Rav Chisda, they're debating why he's not wearing tzitzit. Okay, right? Fine. Adahachi, so while this is going on, Aitu Allahu Gavra, they bring this guy, right, before Rav Chisda and his court, the lo have mukar avuha, who wasn't giving proper respect to his father, Ve'imei, and his mother, right? Kaftu, and they were slamming him. You know, there was a, back then you had a serious rabbinic court system. People didn't respect their parents. I show this Gemara to my children on a regular basis, you know? They didn't respect their parents. There's no, like, no allowance. There's, like, you know, whoop him in front, give him a smack. So they're giving him a shtickle beating or whatever it is, there's different interpretations, because he's not respecting his parents. That's a serious, you know, felony, right? Amalei, so this guy, this no tzitzis, no tefillin from Pumpadita guy, he says, Shefku, leave him alone. The Tanya, because we learn a teaching in a Braita, we learn another teaching. Kol mitzvah taseh, shematan schara betzida. Anytime you have a positive commandment where the reward is mentioned by that commandment in the Bible, in the Torah, human court in such a case can't punish for such a mitzvah. So by respect for parents, it actually says in the mitzvah of respecting your parents, lemanya richun yamecha, in order that you should have long days, that's a reward. Therefore, you're not allowed to give him a punishment. So incredibly, right, they stop punishing the guy because this guy's right. This nachleper, right? Amalei chazinalach decharifa tuva. I see that you can really learn. You're a sharp guy. Amalei, I have it ba'atrei de Rav Yehuda, achavina lachurfaya. If you would come to Pumpadita by Rav Yehuda, I'll show you learning. This is a strange story. And there's a lot you can learn from this story, but I'll tell you the thing that challenges me.
Think about this. It's Erev Yom Kippur. You have a Jew wandering the streets and he's eating raw udders. He has to walk out of town using disgusting twigs to cook them. He's not wearing tzitzis and tefillin. And what do? They haul him before the Rosh Hashiva. Why doesn't anybody invite him home? Why doesn't anybody invite him home? It's Erev Yom Kippur. Now, just so we're clear here, I'm not standing in judgment of Rav Chisda, Chas v'Shalom. He's an Amora and the Talmud. It's not for me to sit in judgment, and we don't even know if the story happens. So I'm not talking about, if what you walk away from here is that you think Rav Chisda is, then you missed the point. The Talmud's sharing a story with you. The dialogue is all wrong. There's something missing. And that's really my question. How did we get there? How is it that we walk down the street and we look at coats and beards and hats instead of what's really inside of a person? And by the way, I don't think it's an accident that this Gemara appears at the end of one of the most detailed, halakhically oriented tractates in the entire Talmud. Because sometimes we get so into the detail that we lose the idea. We're so stuck in how to make the cup of tea on Shabbos that we're screaming across the room to make sure the fellow doesn't stir it wrong, kind of forgetting that meanwhile, we're in the midst of character assassination. And we're embarrassing someone and maybe even losing our portion of the world to come. How do we get there? And what do we do about it? This is the ultimate question. And I want you to know, if you walk away from this discussion with nothing else but that question, it was worthwhile your coming to Shulchan. Because it almost doesn't matter. I'm not a big believer personally in answers. I'm a big believer in sort of figuring out where we are in the question. This is a question we should have all the time. This is one of the most essential pieces in Judaism today. How do we change the way we look at people? How do we change the way we view people? So, put this aside. And here's an interesting one for you. Okay? And just, although I imagine many of you may know this, but just so we can take a look at this together, and we'll see how far we get in this, but at least as a question. Okay? Take a look at this. Okay? Because this is from the Haggadah, you can probably almost guess which piece I'm choosing to start with, right? You know, there's one character in the story of Pesach that fascinates me the most, and that is the Rasha. The Rasha, right? Most people know there are four sons at the Seder, right? The Seder is all about fours, four cups of wine, four questions, four sons. And one of those sons is the Rasha. He's the wicked son. And I'm fascinated by this son. Who is this son? What's he doing there? What do we do to him? And what's the problem? So the Haggadah says, Rasha, Mahu Omer. What does the Rasha say? What does the wicked son say? This is the second chapter. I'm reading in the Hebrew, but you can read in English if you want. Ma avodah zot lachem. What is this service? What is this work to you? Okay, well, what is this to you? Lachem velolo. So the Rasha says lachem to you and not to him. He doesn't say, what's this to us? Right? He's disassociating himself. Right? So if he disassociates himself, that makes him a Rasha. That seems to be what the Haggadah is saying. This is, by the way, from the Haggadah of Passover, right? From the Seder night. Ulefisho tzitatzmo min haklal, and because he removed himself from the general population, right? From the community. Kafar b'ikar, he denies a basic principle of Judaism. Do you understand this? This is an ikar. This is a basic principle. The Haggadah, right, is the theme book. You know, they did a statistical survey, and they discovered that there are two rituals in the Jewish calendar that are more a part of the Jewish people's repertoire than any other two rituals in the entire year. And those are Yom Kippur, okay, and the Seder night. Over 85% of the Israeli Jewish public sits at a Seder every year. That's an amazing statistic. 85%. That's, by the way, including those who aren't at a Seder because they're in the army, etc. It's an amazing statistic. Okay? And the Seder doesn't talk about Shabbat. It doesn't talk about Kashrut. It barely alludes to prayer. What is the Ikar, the main principle that the Seder seems to talk about? Whether you include yourself in the Jewish people or not. Very important. So what do you do to him? Hakei et shinav. So what does hakei et shinav mean? Anybody? What does hakei et shinav mean? What do you mean?
What do you think it means? Somebody must have had this discussion. Pardon?
Hit him in the teeth.
Slam in the teeth, okay? Slam in the teeth. And that's what I always thought. Well, one day I got curious, you know, it's interesting, how do you come to the... Because if that's what it means, that's pretty depressing. You know, you get some guy at your Seder, that's this to you, slam him one. Now that's, you know, that's a... I could work in certain situations, you know, I could make a case for saying that, you know, there are populations and individuals in particular in Israel that might benefit from this philosophy, but, you know, it troubles me. I mean, it's just not my approach to life. So in fact, if you do a little looking, there's a magnificent book. It's called a Concordancia, Concordance. A Concordance, I think we have one here somewhere, a Concordancia is a book which basically lists every place in the Torah that a particular root or word appears. Okay? So if you want to learn what a word means, and here's an example of a concordance. I'll just take it out so if everyone wants to look at it afterwards. If you want to know what a word means, right, and where it appears, you can learn a lot about the context and the meaning of a word by learning what it means. You know? That's how, this is by the way a very important word, so I'm going to digress for 2 minutes, just so you understand this, because some of us have had this discussion before and some of us haven't. We have to be on the same page on this issue. So this is what we call pshat. What does pshat mean? Okay? Most people think that pshat, there are different levels to Torah study. Most people think that pshat means, you know, from the word pashut, means the simple explanation. That's not true. That's not really what pshat means. Pshat is the contextual explanation. And I'll give you the best example I can think of. If you look at the beginning of the Torah, okay, and you're reading a paragraph, and you know all the words except for one word, right? Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, and God said, let there be or. Now let's say you don't know what or means. Well, you really have no way of figuring it out from that sentence. Well, then it says, Vayar Elokim Et Or Kitov, and God sees that the or is good. Well, so now you know or is good, you know, so it's not Joseph Goebbels, but I mean, you know, you don't really know what it is. Okay, then it says, right, Vayavdel Elokim Ben Ha'or V'Nachoshech, and God separated or divided or distinguished between or and darkness. Vayikra Elohim La'or Yom, and God called the or day, V'Lachoshech Kara Laila, and he called the darkness night. So or is today, as darkness is tonight. So what's or? Light. That's pshat. The pshat of the meaning of or is that it's light, because that's what fits into the context. For example, when Joseph runs into his brothers and they want to conspire to kill him, the first thing they do, vayafshitu oto, they strip him of his technicolor coat. Pshat is the explanation that is stripped from the text. Now, you can derive a contextual meaning of a word, not just by looking at that particular story, by looking at the entire Torah. If I see a word appears 50 times in the Torah, and 49 times it means the same thing, then pshat is that that's what it means. So where else do I find this word? This is not a common word. I didn't have a chance to delve into this in depth, but there is one other place that I found from the Concordancia where this word appears, and that's in Jeremiah and Yirmiyahu. And in Yirmiyahu it says, "Biyamim ahem, in those days, lo yomru od avot achlu boser v'shinei banim tikena. In those days, in other words, when the redemption comes, fathers will say no more, right? That the or they shall say no more that the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Right? If you eat a sour grape, your teeth are set on edge. By the way, the understanding of this particular prophecy, this particular nevuah of Yirmiyahu, is that one of the challenges of exile, right, is that the fathers say things that are so sour that it sets the children's teeth on edge. It's a very sad truth that for many people, Judaism and Torah has become sour grapes. You know, you meet people. We've had people come through Israelite who grew up in traditional homes, who went to yeshivot and yeshiva high schools, you know, and sometimes, unfortunately, they receive messages, educational messages about what Judaism is, that are sometimes so sour that you can't imagine how their teeth aren't set on edge. I remember once there was a girl, she came to one of our retreats, and she went to a very, I don't like the label, so we'll call it for the purpose of the example, a religious school, but you know, how you define religious is always a difficult question, but a very, you know, serious, you know, from school, whatever you call it. And she wasn't into it. She was in 10th grade, and she was having a really hard time with things. And one morning, she, you know, gets to whatever it was. So she gets to, you know, they daven in the morning, and they pray in the morning, and she's sitting there in prayers, and she's holding her prayer book, her siddur, but she's not really looking at it, she's not davening. She's not praying. Because she's not into prayer, right? Because nobody's told her what it means. So one of the teachers comes over and says, you know, we'll use a fictitious name, Shendel. You're not davening. You're not praying. So she says, well, yeah, I'm not into davening. So the teacher says, well, you have to daven.
this religious school, you have to daven. So the girl says, well, you can't make me daven. You can't make me pray. So the teacher says, yes, we can. That's part of the curriculum. You're being disrespectful to the school. So the girl says, well, I'm not being disrespectful to the school. I'm coming. I'm sitting. You know, I understand that this is what we do. That's why I'm here and I'm holding a siddur. But you can't make me pray. So the teacher says, yes, we can. We can make you pray. If you don't pray, we're going to expel you from the school. So the girl says, well, this is ridiculous. So she's still sitting there holding the siddur. They kicked her out of school. Can you imagine? Kicked a girl out of school for not davening. So it's not a wonder that this girl eventually ended up in very different circumstances. Because if that's what Judaism is, who would want that? You know, Rav Kook has a deep article called Mimrake Emunah, you know, or Emunah Shei Kfirah, Kfirah Shei Emunah, denial which is faith, and faith which is denial. And he asks, what did atheism come to bring the world? If there's a force in the world, ultimately God has a purpose for that force. So if atheism took the world by storm, what was atheism meant to teach the world? He says atheism has an inner sanctity to it, an inner kedusha. Because what the atheist basically says is, if this is the God that you would have me believe in, I'm not interested. And I'll let you in on a little secret. The atheist is right. Because the God that the atheist doesn't believe in, I don't believe in either. I just don't think that's what God is. And the Judaism that most people don't believe in or are interested in isn't the Judaism that I'm interested in either. I just think Judaism is a little different. But what the Navi Yirmiyahu is saying, what Jeremiah is saying is that through our period of exile, we're going to experience on a regular basis a Torah, a Judaism, a tradition, a heritage that becomes like sour grapes and it sets our teeth on edge. And there will come a time when it will no longer set our teeth on edge. So now that's interesting. Because if that's what that means, then it doesn't mean that you hit him in the mouth. And by the way, take a close look. There's a kuf here, not a kaf. Lahakot is with a kaf. The letter here is a kef, is a kuf. It really means to set his teeth on edge. Now why would you want to set his teeth on edge? I'll tell you the one thing I can think of, which is an interesting discussion, and Ariskin actually once talked about this in a drasha. If you set a person's teeth on edge, you know what happens? You eat something really sour, you know what happens? You can't talk. You can't talk. So if you set a person's teeth on edge, you can't talk. Why wouldn't they want to rush you to talk? And it's very interesting. After the beginning, when the rasha says something, we're doing the talking, he's not talking. Why isn't he talking? Interesting. And because he took himself out of the congregation, set his teeth on edge and say to him, leave a low. Now this is interesting. Because of this, God did for me when I left Egypt. For me and not for him. Now what just happened here? At the beginning of this, I'm talking to the Rasha. I'm talking to him. And you speak to him and say, right? Because of this, right? God took me out of Egypt. Me and not him. If he would have been there, all of a sudden he becomes a he. Now that's very interesting. In order for him to be a he, what does that mean? It means I'm not talking to him. There are two possibilities why I'm not talking to him. One possibility for why I'm not talking to him is because I have no interest in him anymore. Because he's removed himself from the congregation. The other possibility I'm not talking to him is because he's left. Because I've set his teeth on edge. Who would want to stay? And there are different opinions as to what's really going on here. But that is my question. What is really going on here? Right? Very interesting. So, I want to share with you a quick, we only have a few minutes, just a quick idea, which comes out of, by the way, one question that I'm going to share with you, and I'm not going to take the time to give this out right now, but if you look in Exodus, in Shmot, okay, and if anyone wants a copy afterwards, you can come and get one, in Parshat Bo, in chapter 12, Perek Yud Bet, verse 26, Pasuk Avav, it says, V'ayaki yomru alechem b'nechem, when your sons will say to you, there's a different verse in the Torah for each of the four sons. Okay? This is the verse for the Rasha. Okay? V'ayaki yomru alechem b'nechem, ma avodah zot lechem. What is this service to you? It's exactly what the Rasha says. Ma avodah zot lechem. What is this service to you? V'amartem, and you shall say, so what does it say here? It says here, say to him, if you were there, you wouldn't have been taken out. Set his teeth on edge. That's not what the Torah says. The Torah says, V'amartem zevach pesach hu l'Hashem. It's a paschal lamb. Asher pasach al batei b'nei Yisrael. That passed over the houses of the children of Israel. Right? When we were under the plague and saved us. So I don't understand. The Torah tells me that if a kid comes and tells you this, what is this to you? This is what you tell him. You talk to him about the paschal lamb. But the Haggadah says that if this is what a kid says to you, you set his teeth on edge.
And you tell him he wouldn't have been there. He wouldn't have gotten out. Now, what's the difference? And why is there a difference? Okay? So there's an interesting source that that I want to share with you. And this is so worth having, even though we're only going to get to a certain bit of it, that I'm going to give it out anyway. All right? We're only going to get to a piece of it. But if you're curious about some of these sources and some of these texts, then I'll be happy to share them with you, you know, going forward. But this is a fascinating discussion. I've got to give you a little background. We have about 10 minutes and then we'll finish. During the time of the temple, there's a whole area of halakha, of law, of ritual law, that we have completely lost. And those are the laws of purity and impurity. Okay? Now, purity and impurity is an important detail to be aware of. All right? And this is actually going to be part of our tour. We're going to go on a walking tour through the old city soon. So it's kind of going to connect to that as well. What does it mean to be tamei? Have you heard that sometimes a person becomes tamei, becomes impure? Right? Does anybody want to give me an example of somebody who becomes impure? Give me an example. Pardon? A dead body, right? You bang, you know, you're walking down the street, and some guy jumps off a roof and splats, and his hand touches your foot, and you're impure, you're tamei. You got cooties. Okay? Give me another example. If a woman has her menstrual cycle, she's impure, she's tamei, right? By the way, this is not true only for a woman. If a man has a seminal emission, it's a little different today because we don't have a temple, so we don't do anything about it as much. But if a man at the time of the temple had a seminal emission, he was tamei just like a woman. And in fact, in certain instances, if he saw it consistently, like a woman saw her menstrual flow, then he would also have to be unclean for 7 days or whatever. What does that mean? Do you ever wonder what that means? What does that mean that a woman is tamei? I mean, I've looked through different English translations, and sometimes you find English translations that are just very challenging. The woman is dirty, the woman is impure, the woman is unclean. I mean, if that's what I was reading in synagogue, I wouldn't want to have much to do with that either. What does that mean? So the truth is that, I mean, this is a longer discussion, but just in a 90-second microcosm, impurity basically is contact with death. Okay, there are two parts to who we are. There is the physical essence of who we are, right? This is Benny Friedman, but this isn't really me. These are just my arms. You know, if I was walking outside, God forbid, and somebody was juggling buzzsaws, and accidentally I lost both my arms, I'd be a little depressed, but I'd be the same person. Don't go there, right? This is not... I just have weird examples, sorry, right? So, this is not me. So, who is me? Right? So, there is a part of me which is not tangible. It's not physical. And therefore, it's not limited. Right? So, we call that the neshama, the soul, the endless, the chelek elokami mal, the part of us that connects to something higher, that part of us which has no limits, which carries with it the ability to give and to care and to love and to be kind, right? That's my neshama, that's my soul, okay? And we struggle with this. We struggle with the tension between those two realities, because on the one hand, we're physical beings. We need to eat, we need to sleep, you know? You can't not sleep for 40 days. You just can't do it, unless you're Moses, right? You can't not eat. You're going to have to eat or you'll die. So on the one hand, we're physical beings. We're animals. On the other hand, there's a part of us that's way above the animal. You know, there are things that we do that go against every animal instinct. You'll never see a hyena. You know how a hyena eats? Hyenas are very sharp. They wait till the lion kills whatever it's killing. And the lion takes the best choice cut, right? But the lion also has to, you know, it's dangerous to go kill something, right? Lioness, right? She finishes eating whatever they're eating, and then the hyenas pounce and eat the leftovers. Okay? And if you've ever seen National Geographic, you know, one of these films, I mean, they're disgusting hyenas. Go in there and rip out the entrails. You'll never see a hyena sit on the edge of the hunt and say, you know what? This is disgusting. I'm not going to do this today. I'm going to fast. I'm going to have a hyena Yom Kippur. You know, that's just not an animal thing to do. So there are parts of us that are spiritual, that are beyond the physical, and we live with this tension. Are we physical? Are we spiritual? The ultimate reminder, right, that we are in the end physical beings is death. That's the ultimate reminder. We're here today, we're gone tomorrow. Judaism wants me to understand that I'm much more than a physical being. That I have the capacity to go way beyond, to connect to endlessness, to Hashem, whatever that means. Right? So when I come into contact with death, I need to consider that. I need to struggle with that. That has to make an impact on me. It does make an impact on me, and we just have to be aware that it makes an impact on me. And therefore, we almost stop what we're doing. That's why when a person, you know, in Judaism, when you experience death, you sit shiva for 7 days. So what ultimately, for example, is a menstrual cycle? That's the loss of potential life. That's contact with death in a very deep way. Judaism says, when you're in the midst of contact with death, that's not the time to be exploring life. So you stop. And what's the conclusion to that contact with death? You immerse yourself in a mikveh full of water. What is water? Water is life. So that's immersion with life. Okay? And that's ultimately what tumah is. So these issues just be very important. By the way, if you became tameh, if you had contact with death, you didn't go up on that mountain over there, the Temple Mount, because that's a place that's all about life. About real life. Not about physical life. About spiritual life. About endless life. So if you're in the mode of contact with death, which makes you on a certain level very physical, right? So then you don't go up on the Temple Mount. So now this was a big issue. And there are different ways to contract this and different levels of contact with death. If I had contact with death and then I'm eating out of a bowl, the bowl's had some insignificant contact with death. And you're not allowed to eat from a bowl which had contact with me if I had contact with death, because then you have contact with death, so you can't eat certain things in that bowl, and it just made kashrus up the wahoo. I mean, you think it's complicated today to be kosher in the time of the temple? It was unbelievable. And you didn't even know if you could eat from somebody's dish. You went to the ice cream store. First you wanted to know whether the comb was kosher, then you wanted to know if the ice cream cone was kosher, then you had to find out if the paper was pure. Okay? Now, what's really interesting is that there was like a club. There was like a club. And if you were in the club, you were covered. Because you were in the pure club. Everybody could assume you were pure. But if you were not in the club, then everybody assumed you were pure. If you were what's called an Amaretz, and Amaretz were the people of the land, they didn't take these things seriously. They didn't take these things seriously. By the way, we do this today. Right? You go to a toilet in somebody's home, who's on the Forbes 500 list, you don't think about whether you can sit on the toilet seat. Right? But you go to the public bus station, and you naturally assume that if a certain type of fellow comes out of the toilet, you're not sitting on that toilet seat. Now, you don't know that. You haven't biologically examined him. But we make assumptions of people. Right? Don't go there either. Okay. So this is very interesting. This is very interesting. There is an amazing halakha. I want to share with you this halakha, and then we'll see if we can put this all together. Just as an idea. Okay? If you look on page 2 of this, it says, right, that the gabayim, if a thief, this is a Mishnah from Chagiga, it's on page 2 of this handout, if a thief returned vessels, okay, ne'emanin lomana, what does that mean, vessels? In other words, I stole your pots, but then I feel bad, I repented, I bring you back your pots. Now, a thief is an amaretz, a thief is a guy, you don't, if you're stealing, you're not worried about ritual purity, right? Like, you wouldn't steal something and then say, oh, but it's not pure. So you can assume that if a thief had it, it's impure. But no, they're believed to say, lo naganu, we didn't touch it. Uv Yerushalayim ne'emanin al HaKodesh, uv Shat HaRegel af al HaTumah. And in Jerusalem, they have a higher level of belief. And on the festival, they're even believed concerning Truma, concerning the portions that you give to the Kohen. Okay, now what does this mean? Right? So the Talmud, now this is like where I wrote down number 4, right? The Talmud says, right, why is it that on the festival that we believe those people who normally are not to be believed, listen, this is amazing. V'ne'manin al, right, it says, V'yushalayim ne'manin al kodesh, they're believed even on Kachim. In other words, what are we going to do on Passover when we get to Jerusalem on the festival? We're going to offer up a Paschal lamb. Now, Paschal lamb, the meat from Paschal lamb from the sacrifice, which was offered up on the Temple Mount, that's holy meat. You can't just eat that anywhere. You can't eat it outside of Jerusalem, right? And you can't eat it in an impure dish. Not only that, but when you're finished eating the Paschal lamb, this is very interesting, there's a halacha called notar. Notar means that the sacrificial meat all has to be eaten before morning. And whatever's left over becomes unkosher. You're not allowed to eat it. Right? You don't let sacrificial meat, right, become, you know, disgusting. So you have to burn it. And there's debates when you burn it, how you burn it, you have to burn it. Now, if I've got a dish, and I was eating Paschal lamb steak on the dish, at the end of the night, there's residue of the Paschal lamb on the dish. So the dish becomes notar, it becomes leftover from a sacrifice. You can't ever use it again. You have to destroy it. Destroy it, burn it, depends. Now, just think about this, okay? I won't get into how I know these numbers. If you're curious, we can talk about it later. There were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who came to Jerusalem on the festivals. And they're all eating Paschal lamb. That's hundreds of thousands of dishes that had to be destroyed. Can you imagine? You know who made a lot of money before Passover? The dish makers. If you really believe Mashiach is coming, open up a factory for dishes. And you're in. Okay? And if you open one up near Jerusalem, you're flying. call it Messiah bowls. Unbelievable. Okay? He can give us a percentage to Israelite, right? So they had all these dishes. Now, what's the problem? The problem is, right, these dishes are made of clay, okay, because those are the ones you have to throw out, and they couldn't make enough of them. They didn't have enough. And they didn't have kilns to make these dishes in Jerusalem, because those kilns become impure, and you can't have the impurity in Jerusalem. So says the Gemara, okay, why do we believe it, those who are not normally believed about ritual purity on the festivals? She'eno sin kivshonot b'Yerushalayim, because they didn't make these furnaces in Jerusalem. Ubishat haregel afal ha'truma, and on the festivals, right, what are you going to do? Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, the Amar Krai quotes a verse from Shoftim, from the book of Judges, Vayaseif kol yish Yisrael, when all the men of Israel gathered, ala'ir, ke'ish echad chaverim, they become one. Hakatuv asau kulan chaverim. The Talmud says that when we all gather together, we become like chaverim. We become members. This doesn't just mean friends. We become a chavura. It was a chavura that had to eat the Paschal lamb. You had to be part of the group. We all become part of the group. This is amazing. This is amazing. Do you understand this? Technically, legally, all year round, we cannot assume that you are keeping the laws of ritual purity. But when you come up to Jerusalem for the festival, we actually assume that you are keeping the laws of ritual purity. And it's not because you really are. It's because you've become one with the people. And you know what happens, by the way, after the festival? The Rambam says, and this is in the sheet, I'll show it to you afterwards if you want. The Rambam says that when the festival is over, if you have vessels that were touched by those people who now are believed on the festival, after the festival, then, if they go back to their ways, you have to retroactively purify the bowls. It's not because they're really pure. It's because there's a power to the festival to make the pure impure, to allow everybody to become the part of the Chavura. So now turn to this one source. And again, I wish we had time to go through all these, but just as an idea, and that'll allow us to bring it all together. Okay? This is from the Jerusalem Talmud, the Yerushalmi and Chagiga. So the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, adds a piece. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Yerushalayim habnuya. And don't worry if you can't follow in Hebrew. Rebuilt Jerusalem, ki'il shechubra la'yachdav. When you walk from town towards the Jaffa Gate, and you want to have an experience, pay attention to what's on your left side. You get to the corner, and you'll come to the walls of Jerusalem. Okay? These walls were built by Suleiman the Magnificent. They're only 500 years old. Around here, that's modern architecture. But someone put a sculpture there and engraved this verse, that Jerusalem is the city shechubra la yachdav. Chibur is a connection that connects everything together. And most people assume that that just means that the walls are connected. But listen to what the Talmud says. Yachdav, ir shehi osa kol Yisrael chaverim. This is the city that makes of all Jews friends. It brings us all together. Me'ata afilu b'shar yomot ha'shana, amar Rabbi Zeura, u'bilvad b'shar sh'sham alu shvatim. This is only at the time when the tribes all go up together, the festivals. And I'll finish with one last piece that will allow me to connect all of this, because this is such an amazing piece. This is of Tzvi Hirsch Chayut. I got this source from a rabbi, such a fine fellow. He's a rabbi in Scarsdale. He once gave a Shabbos HaGadol Hadrash. This is an amazing source. And if you want to know who he is, you'll remind me, I'll find his name. But Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayut, who's an annotation to the Talmud, says like this, To'elet yamim tovim. This is a commentary on Tractate Nida, Daf Lamed Aleph 34. The purpose of the festivals, Yadua, is known. What's the point of coming all the way up to Jerusalem? Why does everybody have to come up at the same time? V'itchadesh Torah, and the Torah will be renewed. Right? What's the point of it? V'haya ikar hasiba le'aliyat regel, the main reason for the Jews coming up on the festival, mishum lechaber et libot Yisrael ze lezeh, because it connected the hearts of the Jewish people together. The afame aretz, and even those who were not normally religious, whatever that means, ne'amanimas, they are trusted then. On everything. U'mikol ze harishut lechaber ve'ha'am aretz le'chol yachad lechem. So that a chaver, a person who's in the club, the guy with the shrimal and the beard, can learn to eat bread with the am aretz, with the person who doesn't know. To be together.
And through this, tigdal ha'ava, v'yitchaberu ha'levavot zeh lazeh. You want to know what the festivals are all about? I want you to understand something. People wonder, why do people pray for 2,000 years over this building? This temple that we don't have. What's the difference? It's a building. Is it worth what we're going through for a building? The building is just a symbol. What it symbolizes is a place and a time where all Jews could come together. You know, there's a halacha, it's called Maser Sheni. What that meant was that every other year, you know, we think of kosher, we think of kosher meat. Nobody thinks of kosher fruit. But in the land of Israel, if you have a field, and you don't give 10% to the poor, your field is unkosher. Who would have thought of such a thing? This is not ethics espoused. This is not we should give charity. This is if you don't give to the poor, your food is not kosher. Because that's not your food. This is not an opportunity. This is an obligation. If you're not giving, what's the point of your being? And there was another type of tithing. And that was called Maser Sheni, the second type of tithing. And this tithing, you would take a tenth of your field every other year, and you had to bring it up to Jerusalem. It could only be eaten in Jerusalem. Now think about this. If you've got 40 dunams of land, and you're a big farmer, you can't eat 10% of your field in Jerusalem. So what did it mean? But that fruit can only be eaten in Jerusalem. What it meant was you would bring all your produce up, or whatever, redeem it for money, and then buy fruit before you walked into the gates of the old city. And that food that you would bring could only be eaten in Jerusalem. Do you understand this? That meant that in Jerusalem, there was free food. Now, on three times a year on the festivals, the entire Jewish population would crowd into the city. So you had a big party, and all the Jews would come, and they had free food. And by the way, if you had vineyards, that meant free wine. It was a big party. And I got news for you. When you went up to the Temple Mount, there was no Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Ultra-Orthodox section on the Temple Mount. It was just together. There was a time when we had a ritual three times a year that bound us together. That is the essence of the festival. You want to know what's going on in Pesach? The whole theme of the Seder is the family. Pesach is the time that we need to learn to be together. The Jewish people leave Egypt. With all their problems, I'll tell you an interesting thing. There's only one exception to this rule. With all the problems the Jews made in the desert, they were all together. You ever wonder why God doesn't destroy the Jewish people? Because when they mumble together. I want you to know, when my four kids, when they have an issue, and they all come with the same issue, that doesn't bother me. I think that's amazing. If they get along with each other, that's great. It's when they argue with each other, that's when you have a hard time. It doesn't happen in my family. I've heard in other families these things. Right? If we could only learn to mumble together, that would be amazing. The only time, by the way, that you find, or I should say that's not true, the most significant challenge in the entire Torah is the story of Korach, who rebels and causes strife, and that's why that's the only instance where he's swallowed up by the earth and completely obliterated. Because that type of debate has to be obliterated. That's very challenging. Pesach is about the creation of a nation, and the goal of the creation of a nation is that we should learn to be together. You know the most amazing thing about the Rasha? The most amazing thing about the Rasha is that he's sitting at the table. And I sometimes wonder, because if you look in the Haggadah, and we don't have time to do this, if you look in the Haggadah and you look at the Torah, you'll find that the questions of the Rasha, the wicked one, and the one who doesn't know how to ask, they get mixed up. You know why? Because we're not really sure who's who. We don't really know who the Rasha is. And we make a mistake defining a person as wicked as a Rasha, when really, maybe he just doesn't know how to ask. And that's why in the Haggadah, what we say to him is, the big issue with you is just that you're removing yourself from the congregation. And you know whose fault that is? That's our fault. We haven't found a way to include the Rasha at the table. And that is our challenge. That's the beginning of the journey into festivals. The beginning of the journey into festivals, when you really stop to think about it, is how do we as a people come together? And there's much more to say about this, Paschal Lamb and Yitziat Mitzrayim and everything else. But at least it's a beginning.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.